The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. We have no sponsor for this month's program, but if you would like to be a sponsor or if you have any questions, please give us a call at our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with the Reader's Digest Money. How to protect your identity now. And, of course, as we all know, this is one of the major issues we have this time of both the year and also year-round. It's shopping season, which means you'll be looking for a steal. Remember, this is December's issue for a steal. Unfortunately, you have lots of company. Pulling those credit and debit cards out of your wallet, entering your digit onlines, the holidays provide identity thieves with countless opportunities to swipe and swindle. That's an especially big concern this year after the Equifax security breach, which exposed the personal information, including birth dates, addresses, credit card numbers, and Social Security numbers of more than 145 million Americans to potential crooks. As bad as it may sound, let's put the Equifax disaster in perspective. Truth be told, some of your information was probably compromised long before that. Yahoo now says that data breaches have likely affected every one of its users. Target has just begun to settle the cases related to its 2013 credit card hack, involving some 40 million customers. All told, 15.4 million Americans fell prey to identity fraud in 2016. The thieves may seem anonymous, but they do get caught. The Internal Revenue Service has prosecuted ringleaders who paid college students to file false tax returns, mail carriers who stole refund checks, and a Walmart cashier who knowingly cashed forged refund checks. The Department of Justice is on the case, too. Officials believe they know the culprits behind at least one of the Yahoo attacks, Russian intelligence agents. As frightening as the enemies may seem, they can be stopped, and fairly easily. If you are someone who ignores all the advice on how to protect your identity, it's time to act. While these high-tech thieves are certainly sophisticated, there are many monkey wrenches you can toss in their path. Here are five of the easiest and most effective. Fix number one, protect your Social Security number. Your Social Security number is not as secure as you would hope. Of the nine digits, the first three are tied to where you lived when you applied for your number. The next two are a group number within the geographical location, and the last four are your serial number. Since it's not that hard for a criminal to suss out where you were born, it's really only those last four digits that stand between you and all the problems you're trying to avoid. So guard your number with your life. Don't use it anywhere where you don't have to, and you don't have to use it as often as you might think. Jen, not her real name, as her investigation is ongoing, believes that her number was stolen after she included it on a medical form, along with the rest of her personal information. Unfortunately, Jen told Credit.com, the police said people take those forms and sell them on the black market for others to use. The numbers could be stolen by unscrupulous staffers or captured by hackers who tap into the computer system at the healthcare provider or insurance company. That said, you aren't required to give your doctor or anyone else your Social Security number. If you're asked for yours on a form, simply write in supplied upon request. Then discuss it with your doctor's staff, whether they really need to have it. The stealing of Social Security numbers has become such a concern that Medicare has introduced new ID cards for senior citizens that omit the numbers. If you believe that your Social Security number has been compromised, you can change it, though you'll need to provide the Social Security Administration with a valid reason and proof that your current number is being misused. Unfortunately, Jen had plenty of evidence. At first, she didn't know that her identity had been stolen. She found out when she got a rejection for a Macy's credit card she hadn't applied for. When she checked her credit report, she discovered that thieves had taken out a $30,000 car loan and bought a used Lexus, then applied for and received an insurance policy for the vehicle. Experts say that one good way to safeguard yourself is to request a free report form from one of the three major credit bureaus every 4 months and look for anything suspicious. Fix number two, strengthen all your login information. If your passwords and the answers to your reminder questions are easy enough for a thief to guess, then your bank accounts, emails, shopping logins, and other secure accounts aren't secure at all. And yet, cybersecurity firm Caper Security reports that the most common password and used by nearly 1 in 6 online account holders, is 123456. The word password itself is the 8th most common. As unpleasant as it may sound, experts suggest that you have a unique password for every one of your online accounts. They should be as complicated as each site's system can bear, and never fewer than 12 characters, said Richard Rozoko, a computer engineer and an IT consultant. Also, make sure you use a mix of letters, numbers, and special characters. A good strategy is to use a long nonsense phrase you might actually remember. For instance, I wish I had more $3. And that is written with a 1, a W, a 1, a dollar sign, H, a 1, H, an ampersand, a D, an M, an O, an R, and a 3, and a dollar sign, as your bank password, for example. To make managing your passwords easier, some experts recommend using a service such as iPassword, Dashlane, Keeper, LastPass, or Apple's iCloud Keychain. All are free to download. As for your password reminder questions, avoid using anything that could be answered with clues that thieves could dig up on social media or elsewhere online. So no high school mascot, no mother's maiden name, no street you grew up on in 2012, a hacker got into Mitt Romney's personal email by figuring out the answer to the security question, what is your favorite pet? His dog name, Seamus, had appeared in many news stories. The safest question, according to Microsoft and Carnegie Mellon University, may be, what's your father's middle name? It's easy for you to remember, but it's hard for a thief to guess, and it's unlikely to be floating out on the Internet. Other safer questions include, what was your first phone number? And who was your favorite teacher? Some experts recommend answering with a non sequitur. What is your mother's maiden name? Platypus. But any one-word answer is vulnerable, even a random one. Better to use a nonsense phrase here, too. Fix number 3. Lock up your phone. Always keep your device locked and use a strong, long passcode. You can customize its length in settings. Those annoying software updates often address a new security issues, so don't skip them, and don't let apps save your passwords. They can provide an entree to your phone's wealth of personal information. If you take only one extra step, a hacker will pass you up and try elsewhere, says Roger Enderer, founder of Recon Analytics, a telecom research firm. A good safeguard plan is to use a two-factor authentication. Turn it on for your phone via settings and for your various email, bank, credit card, and other accounts you'd like to keep secure. Once it's activated, you'll need two keys to access those accounts, usually a password and a security code. You receive the code in a text, an email, or a phone call from whatever company's site or app you're trying to access. So if you're one trying to access the account on, say, your sister's laptop, you'll be fine. But if it's the thief who doesn't have your phone, he or she won't receive the code and will be locked out. Learn more about how to keep your specific phone safe by using the Federal Communications Commission's Smartphone Security Checker at fcc.gov/smartphone-security. Fix number 4. Don't pay with a debit card. Using debit cards for online shopping is a double serving of daring fate. You're vulnerable not only because you're shopping online, but also because when a debit card is stolen, you may be out of luck. If it's a credit card is hacked, you owe $0 on the fraud. But if your debit card gets hacked, the money is drained from your account, Rozoko explains. You probably won't even realize the money is gone until you get your statement, and by then it's gone forever. Banks will reimburse you if you notify them within 48 hours, so monitor bank accounts activity closely. After a credit card, the next best option is to use PayPal, one payment site trusted by all experts we spoke to. Most agree that the newer Apple Pay and Android Pay options are safe as well. Also, be careful to shop online only with reputable secure websites. How do you know what's secure? Look for a URL that starts with HTTPS. The S stands for secure. And never buy anything when you're on a public Wi-Fi network, because thieves can grab your credit card number and home address. Turn off Connect Automatically settings so that your device's joint join any public network they detect. While no Wi-Fi is 100% safe, your home network has security settings that protect against hackers. Use a strong, long password here, too. Fix number five. Get rid of those pre-approved credit offers. We're not talking about shredding them, though you certainly should. In 2003, the Federal Trade Commission estimated 400,000 Americans had their identity stolen via mail. In fact, mail theft is on the rise. According to the U.S. Postal Service, in one extreme case in June 2016, a postal carrier was robbed at gunpoint in Rancho Cordova, California. The robber, Ron Carlos Maldonado, was part of a ring that stole about 800 pieces of mail, which the thieves scoured for personal information they could use to access bank accounts and open credit cards. Maldonado pleaded guilty to bank fraud, identity theft, and armed robbery. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison. It's easy to stop those credit card offers. Simply call 888-5-opt-out, and financial institutions will remove you from their mailing list. Then, if you aren't planning to apply for a new credit anytime soon, you should put a freeze on your credit report. A freeze will prevent anyone from taking out a loan or a credit card in your name. Of course, that includes you, which means when you're actually applying for credit, say a mortgage, a home equity line, or a store credit card, you'll have to unfreeze your credit file. This can cost $5 to $10 per freeze, and unfreeze through Experian and TransUnion, two of the big three credit bureaus, but it's free for life through Equifax, a concession made by the company after it admittedly bungled its response to its data breach. Another precaution is setting up a fraud alert with one of the credit bureaus. This is a notice on your file that tells lenders to contact you before approving any application for new credit. It's free, and when you place it with one bureau, it will notify the others to do the same. For maximum protection, Consumer Reports recommends you use both a credit freeze and a fraud alert. What It's Like to Have Your Identity Stolen by Chaya Hanay. 2 weeks after enjoying a much-needed family vacation, I was home in California checking my mail when I saw a letter from the IRS. I thought, finally, they sent my refund. Wrong. It was a letter saying my identity theft claim had been received, and they had opened a case. The odd thing was, I never filed a claim. I was puzzled, so the first thing I did was call the IRS. I found out that someone had filed a return in my name in January, 2 months before I usually file. He or she had created a direct deposit account with no name specified and had also filed a change of address form so that my mail would be directed to an old address of mine. Although the Criminal Investigation Unit of the IRS had flagged that tax return as fraudulent, a $1,400 refund was still sent to the direct deposit account with no name attached to it. I couldn't believe it. When my real return arrived in March, the IRS realized that identity theft had occurred and began sending me letters informing me of the theft and the delay of my refund. But I never got those letters because they were sent to my old address and then stolen. I had a real mess to clean up. I had to file a form requesting that the IRS trace my refund to see who had received it. The rep also said that I needed to call the Federal Trade Commission, the Social Security Office, my bank, my tax preparer, and one of the credit bureaus to alert them about what had happened. I also got a special pin to put on my returns going forward, indicating that I experienced identity theft. I finally got my refund money months later. I never found out who stole my identity or whether the crook or crooks were ever caught. Now I'm extra careful about shredding my mail, checking my credit report regularly, and safeguarding my personal information. For example, at doctor's office, I don't write my Social Security number on any forms. Whenever I mail anything to the IRS, I send it by certified mail. I have to take precautions for the rest of my life. It's annoying. The worst part is that the thief or thieves got away with my refund. What a waste of taxpayer money. Drama in real life. It's December in the Arctic Circle, and World War II airman Leon Crane is the lone survivor of a plane crash. He knows that he'll need to be rescued quickly if he's going to live. But does anyone even know he's out there? Lost in the Alaskan winter. It was approaching noon on December 21, 1943, in Tanara River Valley of Alaska, not far from the Arctic Circle, and the five men on the iceberg Inez were preparing to crash. Minutes before, the crew of the B-24 bomber had been testing a modified system on the plane's four propellers when the plane seemed to stall, diving into a roller coaster plunge. G-forces slammed pilots Leon Crane and Harold Hoskin as they lurched at the controls. Wind screamed through the cockpit glass. The airspeed gauge was redlining. The flight instruments were blinking out. Then something that sounded like a pistol shot came from the tail, followed by cracking noises. "Open bomb bays," Crane shouted to the crew chief. "Bail out," Hoskins yelled to the other crew members. The crash alarm bells jangled like a fire drill as Crane janked off his mittens to secure his chute, and then before he knew what was happening, he was in a free fall. He felt for the ripcord. The chute popped out. He swayed beneath it and watched the iceberg Inez spin off before it slammed into a mountain slope and erupted in flames. Crane himself thudded into the powdery snow near the banks of a stream, 2 miles away from his plane, he guessed. The gas on board would keep wreckage burning for a while, which would be good for a rescue mission. But the fire also meant the supplies on board, sleeping bags, signal flares, a gun, and ammunition were lost, almost certainly among with any other crew members who might have survived the crash. Still, Crane shouted out for Hoskins and the rest of the men. He listened for any hint of life. Nothing. He was alone. The sky was already turning dark. Crane took a few stumbling steps and found that the snow covered a jumble-like of rocks that made walking nearly impossible. There was no chance to reach the crash site before nightfall, nor did he have any idea where he was, and a broken ankle would be a death sentence. Fortunately, the 23-year-old pilot had a few provisions to keep him warm until help arrived. He had a silk parachute, which he could use as a sleeping bag. His flight suit was intact. He had on 3 pairs of wool socks under his heavy mukluks. He also had his flight helmet and a pack of matches, as well as a knife. But he didn't have his mittens, which he'd left on board in the rush to prep his chute. Without them, his unprotected fingers could become frostbitten within 10 minutes. He tucked his hands into his armpits and thought back to the last radio contact with the airbase at Ladd Field in Fairbanks. That had been at least an hour before the plane had fallen, which meant the search area would be huge, a radius of about 200 miles from their last known position. It was minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Crane knew he needed to get a fire going or it might not last the night. So he gathered driftwood. His fingers were numb, but he managed to strike a match. The little flame wasn't enough to catch. He tried 4 matches, but they did nothing except singe his fingertips. Then he remembered a letter from his father he kept in his parka. Crane fed it into the wood. The 5th match worked, and the fire rose up. He let the fire thaw his fingers before wrapping himself in the chute. He thought about what would happen if rescue never came. How long, he wondered, would it take to die? In the morning, Crane ran through the odds of being saved. The short daylight allowed little time for search planes, and in this climate, the hunt would be measured in days, not weeks, before it was called off. What if a plane never found him? There was the water gurgling up from the ice in the stream, but he had no food, and his hands were already developing a pasty white look, the first sign of frostbite. Crane was convinced that his best chance of survival was to leave the crash area and explore downstream. The water had to eventually drain into something, he reasoned, probably the Yukon River, and there was a chance of finding a trapper riding out the winter. But first he called out to his crewmen once again. When there was no response, he gathered up his parachute, his matches, and set off. It took hours to cover 1 mile through the waist-deep drips and ice-coated rocks. As the sky darkened, Crane picked a patch of level ground by the stream to build a fire. But he had already burned his only kindling, his father's letter. So it took several matches to get flames going. At this rate, he would have only 2 weeks' supply of matches. As for the fire's warmth, he inspected his hands. They were numb, and the color had drained from his fingertips. It was insanity to try to walk farther, he realized. It was wiser to stay in the vicinity of the crash site for a week, after which the airbase would probably call off the search. Then he'd start walking again. Hunger gripped Crane with an angry, clawing need. He had to find something to eat. Walking in deadly cold under these harsh conditions could demand about 6,000 calories a day. A few days of that and he'd simply collapse. He saw a few red squirrels, one of the few animals that do not migrate or hibernate during the Alaskan winter. Crane broke off a branch, took out his knife, and began to whittle down a point until he had a spear. Then he took aim and threw. The spear flew through the air, wobbly and slow, missing his target by a foot. Next, Crane tried a sneak attack, jabbing at one of the spry animals. He missed, then missed again. Enraged, Crane grabbed rocks and hurled them at the squirrels. "Go to hell," he yelled. Beaten, he spent the next 3 days wrapped in his parachute in a kind of hibernation, climbing out only to drink from the river and feed the fire. Although Crane was alone in the wilderness, he had not been forgotten. The first rescue flight went out of Ladd Field 8 hours after the last radio contact with the iceberg Inez. Within 2 days, more than 20 search missions were launched, all coming up empty. At the base, the crew's bunks and lockers remained untouched for a while. Eventually, though, their personal items were packed up and shipped to the next of kin. With no food and fading hopes, Crane felt a need to do something. He decided the river was too much of an unknown, so on December 29th, 8 days after the crash of the iceberg Inez, he began hiking overland in search of civilization. With each step, he had to plow aside snow. Numbness began to spread downward from his knees. Not a single stride landed easily. He stumbled several times, which forced him to pull his hands from the warmth and safety of his pockets to avoid toppling over. At midday, Crane stopped. In 2 hours, he had gone all of roughly 300 feet. "I'm simply marching to my death," he thought. Crane turned around and followed his tracks back to the campsite on the river. The fire was nearly out, but some wood still glowed. He coaxed the flames from the spruce and cloaked himself in the parachute for another night. He left again the next morning, this time trying to walk atop the frozen river. Crane followed the pathway through wide hills, telling himself around the next bend there would be a cabin with a fire and a family who would feed me some supper and a steaming coffee. But bend after bend, it was just more river, more hills, and there was something else concerning him. It had started with a few moments of disjointed, meandering thoughts, and a few times over the past few days he'd found himself in a daze. Crane felt himself slipping, his judgment fraying, because of cold, hunger, fatigue, and loneliness. Dusk gave way to darkness, and as he blindly trundled on, a log cabin came into view, half covered with snow. He stumbled over rocks, running and yelling, not caring that his hands were exposed. He cleared away the drift and opened the door. The place was about 10 feet wide, with a dirt floor and a low ceiling. A wooden bunk bed stood in the corner. There was a table with burlap sacks on it, tied with twine. His frigid fingers couldn't loosen the knot, so he cut a bag with his knife, sugar. There was a tin of cocoa, one of dried milk, and a box of raisins. Crane stuffed the raisins into his mouth. He lit a fire and filled a frying pan with snow, and soon he was folding a tin cup of hot cocoa in both hands. Then he fell asleep on the bunk. When he awoke, he made more cocoa. Sated, he filled his pockets with raisins and set off downriver, certain that there must be a village nearby. The river bent to the west and the valley narrowed. He hiked on, hour after hour. All he saw was more wilderness. Darkness fell and a half-moon rose in the cloudless sky. The temperature had tumbled down to 40 below, he figured. It was decision time. His hands were too numb to light a match, and he knew he could not ride out the night without a fire. He made a painful choice. There was no village. He had to return to the cabin. He stumbled back along the river. Icicles hung from his nose. It hurt too much to brush them off. To stop was to perish. He just kept his legs moving. One step. One breath. Dawn came, and still there was no sign of the cabin. The landscape was not familiar. He had paid no attention when he'd headed out the previous morning. It was close to noon after 30 hours of walking before Crane saw the cabin again. He staggered through the door and made a fire. Then he wrapped himself inside the silk folds of his parachute and collapsed onto the bunk. Crane spent 48 hours in bed before hunger forced him to his feet. He stepped outside to explore a small shelter he'd noticed earlier. As luck would have it, it held food, clothes, a rifle, ammunition, and most important, a pair of moose hide mittens. Crane used the next 3 weeks to regain his strength. But if he was going to make it, he'd need to carry more supplies. So he took 2 old boards for runners, pulled a window frame from the cabin, and nailed a wash tub to the frame to make a sled. He packed it with food and gear. At dawn on February 12, 1944, 53 days since the crash, he said goodbye to the cabin that had saved his life. He looped a rope harness around his chest and hauled the sled over the riverbank and onto the ice. The going was tough. The harness dug into his chest, and he managed only 1 mile in the first hour. For 4 days he hiked on, his word whittled down by the act of a single step, then the next step. At one point, as Crane leaned forward to push through a drift, the ice folded under his feet. He gulped a breath as the surface gave way, and the sled halted his fall long enough for him to twist around, grab the rope, and haul himself back. He could feel the water leaking through the tops of his mucklucks and soaking his body below his waist. He had to act fast. Crane lumbered toward the bank with the sled in tow. He surged onto the rickety, rocky shore, and with trembling hands that could barely strike a match, made a fire. Crane strung a rope between the two trees and draped his tent over it, forming a crude shelter. He pulled off his flight suit, long underwear, mucklucks, and socks. He was naked and losing body heat. He wrung out his clothes as best he could and laid them near the fire. Then he cowered naked and let the warmth of the fire slow his shivering. The next day, his clothes dry, Crane was back on the move. A week had passed since he'd left the safety of the cabin. His legs just kept moving. Maybe 4 miles a day. He came upon another deserted cabin. Then more days of walking. March 7th. March 8th. March 9th. On March 10th, at first light, Crane stumbled upon a trail and followed it. It led away from the river, then back toward the ice. There, on the other side of the river, was a cabin. Then came barking, the sound of a dog. "Ho!" Crane yelled. "Anyone there?" And for the first time in 81 days, someone answered. A trapper took Crane in, gave him food and clothes, and took him by dog sled to Woodchopper, Alaska, where a mail plane flew him back to Ladd Fjord. He was a lone survivor of the crash of the iceberg NS. Crane met a nurse at Ladfield after the war. They got married and had 6 children. They made their home in the Philadelphia area, where Crane had a career first as an aeronautical engineer and later as a home builder. Leon Crane died in 2002 at age 83. Rarely spoke of his time in Alaska. Other people had faced far worse in the war, he'd explained. What he experienced was, by comparison, simply a breeze. "All I want for Christmas. I wish I had a voodoo doll of myself so I could give it a back rub." Holidays. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, and we've met him. 24 magical, heartening, joyous reader encounters with a jolly man in the red suit. And there's a picture of a young lady on Santa's lap saying, "I want an American Girl doll, Polly Pockets, a gerbil, a karaoke machine, etc., etc." Last year, when our 3-year-old great-granddaughter, Kylie, was taken to see Santa Claus, she made sure to give him her wish list of toys. A week later, she ran into a different Santa in a mall. He stopped to ask what she wanted for Christmas. Kylie was appalled and let him know, "If you can't remember what I told you last week, how are you going to remember on Christmas Eve?" One Christmas Eve, there was a knock on our door. It was a Santa, red suit, white beard and all. My parents invited him in, and he proceeded to pose for photos with us and eat our cookies. After a while, he wished us all a Merry Christmas and left. Once the door closed behind him, we all looked at one another and asked, "Who ordered the Santa?" To this day, we have no idea who that man was. Years ago, drowning in too many responsibilities, I found myself devoid of any Christmas spirit. One day I stopped at a red light as I sorted through my long list of onerous tasks. A beat-up sedan pulled up next to me. Behind the wheel was a Santa Claus belting out Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline. The man did not have a care in the world. Realizing he had an audience, he turned and looked me straight in the eye and shouted, "Merry Christmas!" as he drove off, his enthusiasm lifted my spirits and officially kicked off my holiday season. As my son Mike and I drove to the mall, we passed a Salvation Army Santa ringing his bell. "Mike," I said, "there's Santa." He shook his head. "That's just some guy in a Santa suit," he said. It saddened me to think that maybe my son no longer believed in Santa, and we drove the rest of the way in silence. At the mall, we spotted another Santa greeting young believers. Suddenly, Mike took off toward him. Turning back to me, he shouted, "Now there's the real Santa." A friend asked me to dress as Santa to surprise her son. I went over to their house, changed into a Santa suit in the bathroom, and to the delight of the little boy came out with a loud ho, ho, ho. After a half hour, I returned to the bathroom, changed back into my regular clothes, and exited the bathroom. The boy went in after me. He looked around for Santa. Then, reaching the only possible conclusion, he lifted the toilet seat and shouted, "Bye, Santa!" It had been a rough year. A single father with two young daughters, I was out of work and out of money. With little choice, I told the girls, "It looks like our gift from Santa will be a gift of our love for each other." Then a miracle occurred. I won $1,000 in a contest. I kept it as a secret as I went on a shopping spree and spent Christmas Eve wrapping presents for my girls, all the time thinking, boy, will they be surprised. The next morning, I went to the living room to lay out the gifts and froze. There were already dozens of presents under the Christmas tree, all with my name on them. My girls had felt bad that Dad wouldn't be getting any gifts, so they carefully wrapped their favorite stuffed animals and other toys so that I would have a Merry Christmas. As I stared at the gifts through tear-filled eyes, I promised myself to never again doubt in Santa Claus. On Christmas Eve, my husband went next door to retrieve a gift for our son and daughter. I had just slipped into bed when I heard him return. Our three-year-old son also heard him, and soon he was in my bed, clinging to me nervously, excited that Santa was in the house. We waited in silence for a few minutes until he whispered, "Too bad Daddy can't be here." When Santa came to the nursing home where I worked, the first patient he visited was Margaret. She was confined to her bed, was thrilled when he roared, "Ho, ho, ho," in her doorway. "Santa," she said softly. "Merry Christmas, Margaret. What do you want for Christmas, little girl?" "I want a kiss from you, Santa," she said with a grin. Santa gently took Margaret's hand, bent down, and kissed her. Then he added quietly, "God bless you, Margaret." "God bless you too, Santa," she whispered back. Santa went on to visit every bedridden patient in the home. Afterward, he asked his nurse escort whether he could say goodbye to Margaret. Struggling to find the right words, she told him that Margaret had died soon after he'd left her room. She said that in her final moments, Margaret had spoken of being blessed by Santa. Santa thanked the nurse for telling him and then quickly left the floor. After all, nobody would want to see Santa Claus cry. It was 5 when my brother took me to the firehouse to see Santa Claus, who, unbeknownst to me then, was actually my father. Later, when I got home, I excited told my mother that Santa had boots just like Dad's. She smiled. Then I added, "And he had lots of women come and sit on his lap, too." There went the smile. We immigrated to America from China when I was 6. Because I was shy and didn't speak English, I had few friends. My days were spent at home with my brother. Sometimes we'd help our neighbors, Mr. Mueller, pull weeds. One Christmas day, there was a knock on the door. Grandma opened it, and there stood a big fellow in red with a snow-white beard laughing, "Ho, ho, ho," and handed out presents and made us laugh. I had so much fun. It was years later when I learned that our special Santa was our neighbor, Mr. Mueller. It was Christmas Eve, and our 3-year-old son was wired. "You need to go to bed right away," my husband told him, "because Santa will look in your window and make sure you're asleep before he leaves presents." Suddenly our son's eyes grew big and his voice quavered as he shrieked, "I don't want the big scary man with a beard looking in my window." Needless to say, we were up very, very late that Christmas Eve with our son in bed between us. My nearly 2-year-old granddaughter was reluctant to meet Santa Claus for the first time. Nevertheless, she patiently sat on his lap and waited while we took picture after picture. Finally, having had enough, she figured a way out of her predicament. She turned to Santa and stated, "I pooped." With that, Santa said, "She's done," lifted her up, and handed her back to her mother. While I was president of a state college in New York, I came home from work one December day and drove my 5-year-old son, Brett, to Santa's village. Brett was nervous but excited. He had a long wish list of toys clutched in his hand. When it was our turn, we approached the great man seated in his big chair. That was when Santa, who turned out to be a student at my college, stood up, extended his hand, and said, "Dr. Anderson, this is an unexpected pleasure." Brett dropped his list, stared at me from the stands, and said, "Why didn't you tell me you knew Santa?" I've been hired to appear at a church dressed as Santa, but traffic was so bad my elves and I were late. When we finally arrived, we were met with scowls from the annoyed parishioners. Suddenly the angry silence was pierced by a shout. Santa! A small 4-year-old girl came running from the other side of the room and leaped into my arms. Oh, Santa, she breathlessly cried out, I love you. That turned scowls into smiles. My sister-in-law had driven her 5-year-old son Josh to the mall with the purpose of visiting Santa and telling him what he wanted for Christmas. After parking the car, they got as far as the entrance when Josh stopped, threw out his hand to block their path, and announced, Wait, I forgot the toy catalog. It was December 1935, during the Depression. Although she was a single mother of three, with little money, Mom never turned away any hungry person who came to our door. One day she welcomed in a man with white hair and a great white beard. While she fixed him a meal, he asked me in the kindest way, What do you want for Christmas? Skates, I quickly replied. You'll get them, he assured me. I was elated. Not so my mother, she couldn't afford them. Christmas morning came and there were no skates under the tree. Mother tried to complain that I wouldn't be getting them, but I knew differently. I ran to the front door and threw it open, and there on the porch was a pair of skates. My mother later told me that a family friend had left them there for me, but I knew it was Santa. Several years ago, after numerous fertility drug treatments, I became pregnant. 6 months later, we lost the baby. My husband and I were devastated. A few years and tears later, we tried another round of treatments. But after many months of futility, my wonderful husband said, Neither one of us can take this much longer, so let's agree, if after this last treatment we got pregnant, we'll do something crazy like purchase a 1967 Candy Apple Red Corvette and enjoy our lives as it is. I agreed. Lo and behold, we finally had our bouncing baby boy. A few months later, we were at the mall snapping photos of holding him. As Santa handed our son back, he shocked us both by saying, It's a lot better than a Corvette, no? Funds were tight for my friend Joe and her husband. But Tinker, Joe's 5-year-old, was convinced that since he'd been good all year, Santa would bring him a bike. And not just any bike, but a rare yellow one. Don't worry, Mom, he said. You'll bring it. Joe's sister and her 5-year-old son lived with Joe. And as it happened, that little boy was getting a red bike. On Christmas Eve, I told my mother the story of Tinker and the yellow bike. You can't let that happen, she said. That little boy won't understand why Santa brought his cousin a new bike and not him. Mom handed me a pile of bills. Take this and get him that bike. By now it was late and most stores were closed. I called the only place that sold bikes. A man answered. I asked if he had any boys back left. Only one, he said apologetically. But it's yellow. When I was 8, I attended a Christmas party with my mother. Since Daddy was working late, unfortunately, I had a terrible headache and begged my mom to take me home. She said she would, but only after Santa had passed out our gifts. Then Santa arrived. When he called my name, I sat on his lap. That when I saw his distinctive mechanic's hands covered with grease and calloused. Santa was my dad. Amazingly, my headache didn't hurt so much anymore. My 2 granddaughters had a visit from Santa, my son-in-law's co-worker. Santa asked the 2-year-old, So what do you want for Christmas? Before the shy little girl gave an answer, her 4-year-old sister gave it for her. She wants me to have a Barbie doll. Because we didn't have much money, our family focused less on gifts giving and more on the birth of Jesus. But that doesn't mean we went without. We lived close to a Franciscan convent, and each Christmas the nuns brought us a huge box overflowing with aromatic baked goods, some dipped in decadent chocolate, others in a chewy fruitcake texture. What a treasure to discover that Santa dresses in many colors besides red. Sometimes Santa arrives in plain black dresses and can bake. On Christmas Eve, Dad wanted us to experience watching Santa place gifts under the tree. So unknown to my siblings and me, he had a co-worker dress as Santa and come to our house around the time we were going to bed. When Dad's friends sneaked into the house, I was so excited to see Santa. So was our dog who attacked him. I reached the kitchen in time to find red and white fur on the floor and see Santa leaping over the back fence for his life. By the time I was 7, my parents had been divorced 3 years. Still, when we woke up that Christmas morning, Daddy was there. My little sister and I were told there was a gift from Santa waiting for us outside. We sprinted out the door, and there it was, a beautiful white playhouse complete with a front porch. Inside it was furnished with a table and two chairs, a small baby cradle and two dolls, and a kitchen area with dishes. Daddy had constructed it while Mother bought the furniture and made the curtains. We spent the morning eating breakfast in our little white playhouse with Mother and Daddy. Even though our parents were no longer together, we knew they would always be together for their girls. And they were. From office get-togethers to swanky shindigs, you can commit a party foul anywhere. These tips can help save you. 'Tis a Season of Social Disasters by Laura Lee. The awkward greeting. Smiling conveys openness and warmth, but if you immediately jump into a full-on grin, you may come across like a salesperson. Instead, try this trick. Stand in front of a mirror and repeat the word great in a number of funny voices. This should make you smile. The next time you meet someone, think great, and you'll flash a natural-looking smile. Keep your arms uncrossed and your hands unclenched. If you can, stand up for greetings. If you're in a booth at a restaurant and can't get up, extend your hand and say, "Excuse me for not standing. Pleased to meet you." Lastly, poor eye contact will make you seem dishonest, but don't carry it too far. If you stare too long, you'll make the other person uncomfortable. The joke's on you. This may sound obvious, but to tell a joke, you have to remember it. The biggest joke disasters happen when you launch into your humorous tale only to discover that you have not quite committed the pertinent details, for example, the punchline, to memory. So as soon as you hear a joke that you might want to tell later, write it down. Telling a joke is not the reenacting the Barber of Seville. Be brief, upbeat, and to the point. Get to the punchline in as few steps as possible, but be sure you don't leave out any important bits. Playing past the baby. When you meet a new baby, there's a good chance that someone will ask you whether you want to hold her. If you're a type that gets nervous about this, have faith. You do not randomly drop other things, so the odds are you can manage to cradle a newborn for 2 minutes. Just relax and let the baby rest in your arms. The main thing to remember is that you need to support her head in the first 4 to 6 weeks. A baby's head is actually heavier than the muscles the neck can handle, and she won't develop a neck control to hold up her own head until she is 3 or 4 months old. It's not necessary to bring the baby a gift, although it's not wrong to do so, and will likely be appreciated. If the new arrival has siblings, bring something small for them too, so they do not feel jealous. Showdown at High Spoon. If you're not one for parties with formal table settings, there's a simple rule that will keep you from committing a cutlery gaffe. Start with the outermost fork and work your way in. There is an exception. A soup spoon may be needed before you get to the next fork on the lower left. But it should be obvious that even the stiff set does not use forks for soup. Bread is the most common way people mess up on etiquette, at least in the minds of those with an eye for such things. Instead of biting into a whole roll, put it on your bread plate and tear off a bite-sized pieces to butter and eat. You should also check your napkin use. Once everyone at the table is seated, unfold the napkin and lay it across your lap. When you finish eating and leave the table, loosely crumple your napkin to hide any stains and set it to the left of your plate. Meet my ex-best friend's lover's son. That's an interesting combination. If you're over 30 and have been with the same guy for 3 years, but you are not married, calling him your boyfriend seems childish. Significant other is a euphemistic mouthful. Partner sounds as if you're in business together, and lover seems too steamy. How do you introduce him? Among similar lines, how do you introduce your ex-husband, or his sister who is still your friend, or his biological children with his new wife? Simply introduce the person by name. Debbie, I'd like you to meet Ian. Ian, this is Debbie. As the conversation progresses, the subject of how you know each other may come up naturally. You can decide then how much to discuss. Disclose. Most people you will meet will not need to know, not will they even be interested in, your family history and dramas. Champagne and suffering. You do not want the bubbly bottle to be vertical when you're opening it, or you might shoot yourself in the face. If it is too close to horizontal, however, the gas will float up and form a bubble on the bottle shoulder. When you remove the cork, the bubble will expand all at once, shoot the liquid out of the neck. It looks impressive, but it's messy, and you'll waste some expensive or even cheap champagne. So the angle you're looking for is 45 degrees. This tilt will ensure that the gas stays in the neck. Still, just to be sure, do not aim the bottle directly at any person or anything fragile. It is considered a social faux pas to destroy your Aunt Minnie's collection of precious moments, figurines. To avoid losing your grip and accidentally dropping the bottle on your feet, twist the bottle rather than the cork. Post-party disorder. Dehydration is one of the main causes of hangover symptoms. The best thing to do is alternate each alcoholic drink with a glass of water. The next day, drink a lot of water or an electrolyte solution such as Gatorade. Even though you may not feel like it, eat a well-balanced breakfast. Alcohol raises your insulin levels, which can make you feel weak. Eating will raise your glucose levels. If you feel nauseated, snack on toast or crackers to settle your stomach. Avoid coffee. Caffeine narrows your blood vessels and boosts your blood pressure, which will make your hangover worse. Also, as much as you want pain relief, steer clear of ibuprofen, aspirin, and acetaminophen. It may aggravate inflammation in the stomach and liver caused by alcohol. Now to Consumer Reports. I realize that most of our listeners do not drive because of visual problems, but however, some of you do, and even those that don't ride with people. So this is kind of an interesting thing that you probably should know, even though we don't get a lot of snow in this area. Winter driving, your survival guide. It has been 40 years since Goodyear introduced the very first all-season tire with its Tiempo line. Before the launch of All Seasons, mainstream tires were designed for most wet and dry conditions. But if you wanted to travel on snow and icy roads, you need something more aggressive. Either snow tires or chains wrapped around your daily tires to provide winter traction. These days, most vehicles are outfitted with all-season tires from the factory. All-season tires feature extra slits, called slipes, and a tread designed to give them better gripping ability in snow and ice. They can handle most weather situations, but they don't deliver the best performance when conditions get really bad. That's because no one tire can perform perfectly in every situation. Even though all-season tires offer good traction in most weather conditions, they are a compromise, says Gene Peterson, CR Tire Program Manager. They neither perform as well in dry and wet as summer tires, nor give as much traction in snow as winter snow tires. Consumer Reports tests show that when roads get nasty, winter snow tires easily outperform most all-season tires. Winter snow tires tend to have a deeper tread to grip snow, plus rubber compounds designed to remain pliable in the cold. If you regularly drive on snow-covered roads or if you have to be at work regardless of the weather conditions, we recommend getting 4 winter snow tires for balanced traction and handling. On the other hand, if you rarely get snow or if it's gone quickly, stick with All Seasons, preferably a set that is rated highly for snow traction and ice breaking. Expert tips for safest trips. Patience, preparation, and anticipation will help you keep you safe in snow and ice. Driving in winter will test even the most attentive, skillful driver. Heavy snowfall can reduce visibility, and slippery road conditions can send your car sliding off in unexpected directions with no notice. CR's engineers routinely test tires and vehicles in snowy, icy conditions. These tips from our track experts can help you make it to spring unscathed. Clear the snow and ice off your vehicle's hood, roof, and windows before you drive. Be sure to use a brush with soft bristles so you don't scratch the car's paint. Your visibility will improve dramatically, and other drivers won't have to dodge clumps of snow or ice that can become airborne as you speed down the highway, says Jake Fisher, director of auto testing at CR. Plus, ignoring your car's snow load could cost you. Several states, including Connecticut and New Jersey, can fine you if you don't clear the snow off before driving. Don't forget to check your headlamps and taillights. They could be covered in snow, ice, or road salt. Smooth out your driving style. On slippy roads, tires lose their grip more easily. The key is to drive as smoothly as possible, avoiding sudden actions and rapid movements of any kind, says Gene Peterson, program manager for tires at Consumer Reports. Drive as if you have a full cup of coffee on the dashboard and don't want to spill any. steer into a slide. When your car's rear begins to slide during a turn, gently let up on the accelerator and turn the steering wheel in the direction that the car is sliding. This will help straighten it out. If your car is sliding straight ahead when you're trying to make a turn, your initial reaction might be to keep turning the wheel. That could hurt more than help. Instead, lift gently off either the accelerator or the brake and straighten the wheel, which gives your tires a chance to regain some grip. All-wheel drive isn't all-wheel stop. Despite what many drivers think, vehicles with four- or all-wheel drive can slide on slick surfaces, says Sean Conclair, automotive engineer at CR. Four-wheel drive and all-wheel drive systems provide extra traction only when accelerating. They provide no advantage when braking. Don't pass the snow plows. Let the trucks do their job, says John Ebbetson, chief mechanic at Consumer Report. The road is likely more treacherous in front of those trucks, and you run the risk of sliding as you accelerate to pass them. Don't follow too closely. You might end up with a cracked windshield from flying pebbles. Use winter-grade windshield cleaner. It's specially formulated to stay fluid even in the coldest weather. Slick roads are often treated with a safety solution. With a salty solution, salt crystals and/or sand to provide traction. This wintry mix can really hurt your visibility when it's splashed onto your windshield, especially when you're driving into the sun. Keep an extra bottle of wiper fluid in the trunk in case you run out at an inconvenient moment. 7 car features that take the sting out of winter driving. More cars are offering winter-friendly features than ever before. Though some of these are rare, others are showing up even in less expensive models. Often, several of these features are bundled into a cold weather package, so they'd be difficult to order a la carte. Some of them are just for convenience, but many will keep you safer, too. Remote start. Like a remote control for your car, these devices let you start your car's engine from inside your home or office to warm up the cabin in advance. Certain new vehicles, including Mercedes-Benz and Volvo models, can remote start via smartphone. Heated seats. Seating services can warm you faster than your car's heater can warm the cabin air. Certain luxury cars, such as BMW 5 and 7 Series and Mercedes-Benz S and E Class, have heated armrests and door trims as well. A few years ago, you had to spring for leather upholstery to get heated seats, but many automakers, such as Hyundai, Jeep, and Subaru, now offer the option with cloth upholstery. Heated steering wheel. An electric heating element runs along the outside of the wheel to warm it, giving drivers a comfortable, mitten-free grip. Some wheels in select BMW, Fiat, Chrysler, and Volkswagen models can be set to turn on when the temperature drops below a set point. Heated side mirrors. Heating elements like the ones used to defrost your back window can clear ice and frost from mirrors without the need for scraping. Windshield wiper de-icers and washer jets. Ice and slush can cake up your wiper blades and block your washer jets. So some cars have electric heating elements underneath the resting option of wiper blades and in the jets to melt icy obstructions away. Some luxury vehicles from car makers such as Audi, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Porsche, and Volvo also have washer jets for the headlights to keep them clear and you safer. That will get the grime off the headlights, but if they're caked in snow or ice, you should clear your headlights off before driving. Heated windshield. These are still rare, seen on certain Jaguar, Land Rover, and Volvo models, but they can make clearing ice easier. One downside, the heating elements are made up of wavy lines across the windshield that can be distracting. Plus, we found that these elements can block the signal of troll transponders, such as Easy Pass. Snow-friendly beam windshield wipers. These one-piece wiper blades have spring steel incorporated into the rubber. As a result, they can provide a more uniform pressure on windshields and a better wiping performance. But your testing has shown that cheap beam replacers can hurt performance. Good ones cost $20 to $60 for a pair at Amazon.com. A pair of conventional wipers can cost $15 to $50. Know your snow. Deep pack snow. This is where winter snow tires shine. They're engineered to provide optimum traction here with rubber that stays soft and pliable in bitter temperatures, which improves grip. These tires also have slits that act as biting edges to help maintain control. Slick, icy roads. Studdable and studless winter snow tires work well here. Studdable ones have holes in the tread to hold metal studs. The studs claw the ice, improving grip. Studless tires have rubber that has been formulated to enhance grip on snow and ice, and therefore don't need studs. They work like a squeegee on ice. You can actually hear that sound when you stop. Melted snow and dry pavement. In these conditions, winter snow tires generally do not grip as well as all-season tires, and their tread wears faster. You want to sleep them for your regular tires when spring rolls around. Don't leave home without these. Emergencies on the road can be extra dangerous and stressful in frigid weather. Here's what to include in your wintertime car safety kit. A cell phone. Also pack a car charger because areas with weak reception can kill your battery quickly. First aid kit. Many new cars have one. If your car doesn't, make your own with bandages, gauze pads, medical tape, and antiseptic wipes. Warning light, hazard triangle, or flares. Make sure that flares are kept dry and out of the reach of children and that they have not expired. Water and foods with a long shelf life. Think granola and protein bars, which can last through the winter months. Tire jacks and lug wrench with tire sealant or portable compressor. Whether you have a spare or not, many new cars don't. Know how to fix or change a flat before it happens. Flashlight. Check it monthly to make sure it's still working and pack an extra set of batteries. Tubes of sand. You can find these at hardware stores in the winter. Spread the sand around your tires for extra grip if you're snuck in the snow. Jumper cables or a portable battery booster. Make sure to top off and check the charge on battery booster packs every so often. Foil-lined safety blanket and extra layers of clothing. The blanket's foil helps reflect body heat, keeping you warmer. Also, pack winter boots and socks. Make sure your kit is safely secured in your vehicle. Store it in the trunk or pack it safely in the very back of an SUV. We'll close with a little bit of humor in uniform. The veterans who attend our church were invited to wear their uniforms one Sunday. My husband, who did not wear his, instead stood up and pointed to his lapel and the 1st Cavalry Division emblem he'd received in Korea. He then explained sheepishly, "This is the only part of my uniform that still fits." And we've run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so very much for listening.